Hello and welcome to the opening episode of season eight of the Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I'm Ray Blake, and with me, as you can hear, is my co-host, friend and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
I'm going to say it again, Ray. Season eight.
God. I know.
And hello, Ray.
Thank you. We've got an odd one today, Graham.
When haven't we got an odd one, Ray?
Well, there's that. But I mean, we're going a little off-piste, even for us, and having a challenging look at one of the fundamental principles of financial crime compliance.
Well, what's that then, Ray? Is that the measure twice, cut once principle?
No, not that one.
Neither a borrower nor a lender be principle?
Oh, as if, Graham. No lending, no industry to speak of.
Well, no, that's a fair point. So what is it that you're wanting to dig into then?
Well, I want us to look at the nature of what we call low risk and properly think about what that label means.
I see.
Because without properly understanding that, the very foundation of financial crime compliance, the risk-based approach, will be compromised from the start.
Ooh, strong words, Ray, but you're right. And actually, we often see people have a fundamental misunderstanding of low-risk cases and control systems that don't recognise the nature of low risk.
Can we offer some examples of that in action, Graham?
Yes, and some of these might be subtler than others, but all of them ought to cause concern if you see or hear them around your organisations. I'll start with the way we often see MI and reports presented that distinguish between low risk, medium risk and high risk statistics. A typical colour coding is green, amber and red.
Yeah, that's a good one. Listeners might want to reflect on what they think the issue might be with this and the other examples as we share and run through them. I've got one too, and that's the situation where a firm sets the majority of its clients as high risk.
Yes, that's not a good sign. And how about those where the firm has very few or no high risk clients at all?
The opposite, but just as worrying.
Anything else for you, Ray?
Well, there's having a blanket application of SDD, simplified due diligence, to whole classes of clients.
Yes, now this used to be common, but it certainly shouldn't be now.
You still see it, though.
And here's a subtle one, where EDD, enhanced due diligence, is never applied for a low-risk client.
Oh, yes. And then there's the risk appetite or policy statement that says we have a zero tolerance for financial crime.
Yeah, and all of these things are signs, aren't they, Ray, that the business misunderstands the nature of financial crime risk and specifically of low financial crime risk.
Yes, they are, Graham. So let's explore what low risk means, shall we? Starting with what it doesn't mean. First of all, low risk is not no risk.
And that's a big one for me, Ray. And it's why the use of RAG, red, amber, green, colour ratings for low, medium and high always bothers me. Because red means danger and green means safety. Green says this is fine. Subliminally, it communicates no risk, and that's wrong.
Is there such a thing as a no-risk client, Graham?
No, there isn't.
And that's primarily because the client may not be what they appear to be always, right?
Yes. If your client today is just a regular person or business without any specific high-risk factors, you may well think they present little risk of financial crime.
And that's probably true, but there are two caveats. First, financial criminals usually present exemplary KYC and will credibly present themselves as low-risk clients. There's no point as a financial criminal presenting a different face and then not making it a very innocent one. People fake low-risk identities, not higher-risk ones.
And that's a good point, Ray. What's the second caveat?
Well, simply that your client today may not be the same as the person who presents themselves as that client tomorrow.
Well, because of identity theft.
Yeah, possibly. Or if it's a corporate, because of a change in ownership or control.
Yes, and that could be a legitimate business sale, or it could be deliberately done secretly to install new high-risk owners or controllers without anyone realising.
So how would you tell that had happened?
Well, only by the client's behaviour changing, Ray.
Which means you'd need to be looking for such changes, including in your low-risk populations.
Well, especially in your low-risk populations, Ray, because in the higher-risk cases, you'll be more closely monitoring them anyway through various controls and alerts.
True. Are we saying that low-risk is high-risk and high-risk is low-risk?
Well, it's not a saying I can see catching on, if you ask me. But I think it does encapsulate an important perspective.
Okay, so that's clear then. Low risk doesn't mean no risk.
Indeed. And that brings us to those we have a zero tolerance statements. They're just not credible. And fundamentally, they mean you don't adopt a risk-based approach.
That deserves a bit of explanation, I think, Graham.
Of course. So the risk-based approach is predicated on the principle that no firm has unlimited resources to dedicate to compliance. Given that, the idea is that you ration those resources so they are more generously applied where the risks are higher than when they are lower.
That means you end up applying a lower level of scrutiny to some cases than to others. Things could slip through, though.
Exactly, Ray, and that is accepted. If you'll excuse me using a sporting metaphor, and for a change not a football one, when I'm about to bowl a ball in a cricket match, I will have deployed my fielders so as to minimise the chance of the batsman hitting a long ball and scoring runs. But I haven't got unlimited fielders. I have to put those 9 people, allowing for the bowler and the wicketkeeper.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Where I think they are most likely to thwart the batsman. But there'll be gaps. I could still find the batsman hitting a 4 or even a 6.
That's a great analogy, Graham. In a risk-based approach, claiming a zero tolerance for financial crime is a bit like saying you can bowl out your opponents in cricket for 0 runs scored.
You've got it.
So what about these situations where a firm has most of its clients set as high risk, or none of them? That's also about misunderstanding the risk-based approach, isn't it?
Yes, it is, absolutely.
But don't we have to accept that some businesses are inherently carrying more financial crime risk than others?
Oh, yes, we do.
I mean, firms will be targeting different types of client for different types of products and services in different catchment geographies. Some firms will attract generally riskier clients than others.
All of that is completely true, Ray, and yet every firm still has to apply a risk-based approach.
So in that context, low, medium and high risk are comparative, aren't they?
Exactly. Ray, one firm's low-risk client may be another firm's high-risk client. It's hard to directly compare across different businesses, and that's okay.
So the idea is that the firm has analysed the financial crime risks it faces across its own specific client base and establishes the baseline riskiness of the overall portfolio, and that's what constitutes low risk in that firm.
Yes, that's correct. It can then, in its client risk assessment, identify those factors that elevate the risk above that baseline level. That will determine which clients qualify as higher than low risk, so medium or say high.
So, and here's the entire point of this. I need to set my baseline controls that apply to all clients, low risk and above, according to the overall general riskiness of my business and my clients. So if I'm running a riskier business, my low-risk controls would be more strenuous than in a firm that has a lower-risk business model.
That is it exactly. As a low-risk client in a firm with generally higher risk, you might face quite similar controls to those you'd face as a high-risk client of, say, a domestic retail bank.
And the high-risk client controls in an inherently riskier firm would be higher still?
Absolutely. And that's how every firm is expected to adopt its own risk-based approach.
And crucially, it means that low-risk client doesn't empirically have a fixed definition. It will be different from firm to firm.
You've got it.
So to take an extreme example, a firm that catered only for politically exposed persons, for PEPs, would assign some of them a low-risk rating.
Yes, now that is an extreme example, but you're absolutely right. In that event, the firm's standard low-risk controls would have to include enhanced due diligence because they need to apply that to all PEPs. But those with particularly high-risk indicators would face even more stringent EDD or additional controls to reflect the even more elevated risks.
And at the other end, if you have a really low-risk business and client base, you'd still have to identify those that sat at the riskier end of your distribution curve, right?
Absolutely. No firm can say they don't have any high-risk clients because it's relative to their overall client base. And there will always be an outlying tail of riskiness, even if at some other firms these might be regarded as quite low-risk clients.
So, I think that the only two aspects of this misunderstanding we haven't looked at are those around SDD and EDD.
Yeah, let's start with SDD, shall we? First of all, what is SDD?
Well, the first thing to know is that it's not what it used to be. Simplified due diligence was introduced into the rules to allow firms for types of client or types of product where the financial risk attributes were deemed particularly minimal to take what we might call a light touch approach to due diligence.
And what did that entail, Ray?
Well, for one thing, you were allowed not to determine who the beneficial owners were.
Now, that would have represented a major saving of time and resources for many firms choosing to apply it. So many of them did. What changed?
Two things, Graham. The first is that the UBO concession was taken away. You could relax the evidence you might obtain for SDD cases, but you still had to know who the UBOs were. But secondly, there was no longer the power to apply SDD by default to whole populations or groups of client or products. The fourth anti-money laundering directive introduced a new requirement for firms to determine that each client where it proposed to apply SDD actually and individually posed a lower financial crime risk.
Now, in a way, that puts the kibosh on SDD for me. The risk of getting that wrong or neglecting to make and record that determination every time is just too high given the eroded benefit I get from applying SDD instead of just regular CDD, customer due diligence.
And most firms arrived at that same answer, Graham. Any firm applying SDD by default now to any group or types of clients is not meeting the regulations and misunderstands the nature of low risk in the current regime.
And that's clear. But what about EDD, enhanced due diligence? That's not generally applied outside of high risk. What's the place of EDD for low risk clients?
Well, Graham, we saw in the case of that inherently high-risk firm, the one that specialised in PEP clients, that EDD would be business as usual, even for what they considered their low-risk clients.
That's true.
But in all firms, there will be times where EDD needs to be applied to low-risk clients.
So, give me an example.
Well, I could give you a few, Graham. One would be where a low-risk client undertakes a transaction that's unexpectedly large or complex or not in line with your understanding of the client and their usual activity. Or maybe where there is an unusual pattern of transactions or where transactions have no apparent economic or legal purpose.
Okay, but doesn't that make it high risk?
Well, it might do, but until you apply EDD and do some more investigation, you don't know. It might prove to be entirely innocent. If, after investigating, you have concerns, then you may well increase the risk rating to high to ensure that there's enhanced ongoing monitoring. But the law says simply that you have to apply EDD, not that you have to set the client to high risk.
Hence applying EDD to a low-risk client.
Indeed, Graham. And more generally, firms tend to use a high-risk rating as a trigger to apply EDD. But actually, it should be used more flexibly in lower-risk situations too, where you want to use it to confirm a low risk rather than rely on an assumption, say.
You know, that makes complete sense. So EDD cases and high-risk cases are not necessarily the same thing.
That's right. And where the two always correlate without exception, it's a sign that the firm misunderstands the nature of low risk.
Well, that's been a very useful conversation, Ray. Do you know, it's so rare that we revisit these underlying concepts that we take so much for granted, but sometimes it is often extremely worthwhile.
So where do we want to go next, Graham?
Well, now, Ray, you recently wrote an article for our Patreon subscribers about remediation exercises, and I thought we might expand that into a full podcast episode. There are some really useful pointers on how to do it right and how to do it wrong, and I think our listeners might like to hear it.
Okay, I'll look at working that up then.
I'm looking forward to it.
That's twice in a row now, Graham. That's my line.
Sorry, Ray.